officers in the other military branches or from the civilian development and intelligence agencies. Everybody wanted to know what we knew, what we were spending, and what we were spending it on. And we had no quarrel with telling anybody who wanted to know exactly what kind of goods the American people were getting for their money, except when it came to one category, Roswell. That's when the mantle of darkness would fall and our memories about where certain things came from became very dim, as it did with the dramatic improvement in night vision technology shortly after the summer of 1961. Even our own people became very frustrated with us when General Trudeau would turn to me at a meeting and say, "You know that night vision information you sent over to Fort Belvoir a while back? Where'd you find that file, Phil?" And if I couldn't play dumb and say, "I don't think I ever came across this before, must be someone else in charge," then I'd simply shrug and say, "I don't know, General, must have been in the file somewhere, I'll have to go back and look." It was an act, and many of the officers who suspected we had a stash of information somewhere knew we were covering up something. But if they were career, they also knew how to play the Pentagon version of Steal the Bacon. We had it, and we were hiding it. No one would find out anything unless we let them. So the general would typically hand off anything having to do with military intelligence information to me, and I would usually find a way not only to lose the answer, but also to lose the question as well. We became so practiced at this that entirely new inventions could find their way into development at many different places at the same time without anyone's ever becoming aware of the source of the technology, especially the officer who was assigned the task of project manager within our very own division. The CIA got so frustrated at not getting information out of us that they began keeping closer tabs on the Russian attachés floating around Washington and working under their KGB controllers at the embassies and consulates. Because the CIA knew how thoroughly our universities had been penetrated, they figured they'd get information on the rebound by photographing what was inside the photocopiers at the Russian embassy in Washington. And sure enough, from the rumor mill circulating around the exchange of scientists between industry and academia, the CIA knew that we were onto something at Army R&D and kept the circle as tight around us as they possibly could. So I had to keep close tabs on the general, not letting him go into meetings, any meetings, unprotected, and always making sure that the CIA knew that they would have to climb over me to get to General Trudeau and anything he knew. And the CIA knew that I knew what they were doing and where their loyalties lay, and also knew that it would have to come to a showdown someday. General Trudeau and I had quickly established our routine in early 1961. And our categorization of how we did our job seemed to be working. Night vision was under development at Fort Belvoir, and researchers who worked with us had made sure that the silicon wafer chips had gotten to their colleagues at Bell Labs and assured us that a new generation of transistorized circuitry was already finding its way into development. The silicon chips were a covert reintroduction to the people at Bell Labs because the initial introduction of the integrated circuit chips from the Roswell crash had reached defense contractors as early as 1947 in the weeks after the material reached Wright Field. A similar history of introduction and reintroduction had occurred with stimulated energy radiation, a weapon the early analysts believed they were looking at in the wreckage of the Roswell craft. Since directed energy radiation was a technology we'd already deployed in World War II, seeing what they thought was a super advanced version of that technology, so advanced as to be in a completely different realm, so excited the analysts at Wright Field that they wanted to get it out to research scientists as quickly as possible, which they did. And by the early 1950s, a version of stimulated energy radiation had found its way into the scientific community, which was developing new products around the process of microwave generation. Most Americans who were alive in the 1950s remember the introduction of the microwave oven that helped us live better electrically in our new modern kitchens. One of the miracle appliances that burst onto the scene in the 1950s promised to cook food in less than half the time of conventional ovens, even when the food had been completely frozen. Marketed under a variety of brand names, including the now historic Radar Range, the microwave oven cooked whatever was inside not by the application of pure heat, the way conventional ovens did, but by bombarding the food with showers of tiny waves of electromagnetic radiation, usually only a centimeter or so long. The waves would pass through the food, exciting the water molecules deep inside and causing them to align and realign back and forth with greater velocity. The molecular activity generated heat from within and the food cooked from the inside out. Once you enclosed it in the right kind of a container to keep all the moisture from evaporating, you had a quick cooked meal. The theory behind the microwave oven that started us down the long and profitable path of stimulated energy research was formulated in 1945, with the first commercial microwave ovens rolling off the line at Raytheon in Massachusetts in 1947, before any dissemination of either intelligence or material from the crash of the Roswell spacecraft. But in the wreckage of that craft, the scientists from the test firing range at Alamogordo reported that the inhabitants of the craft seemed to use a very advanced wave stimulation instrumentation that, according to their analysis, bore a relationship to the physics of a basic microwave generator. The retrieval team that pulled the wreckage out of the desert also found a short, stubby, internally powered flashlight device that threw a pencil-thin, intense beam of light for a short distance that could actually cut through metal. This, the engineers at Wright Field believed, was also based on wave stimulation. The questions then were, how did the EBEs use wave stimulation, and how could we adapt it to military uses, or slip it into the product development already underway? By 1954, when I was at the White House, the National Security Council was already receiving reports of a theory developed by Charles H. Townes that described how the atoms of gas could be excited to extraordinarily high energy levels by the application of bursts of energy. The gas would release its excess energy as microwaves of a very precise frequency that could be controlled. In theory, we thought the energy beam could be a signal to carry communications or an amplifier for the signal. When the first Maser was assembled at Bell Laboratories in 1956, it was used as a timer because of the very exact calibration of the wave frequency. The Maser, however, was only the forerunner of the product that was to come, the laser, which would revolutionize every aspect of technology it touched. It would also prove to be a weapon that would help us deploy a realistic threat to the EBEs, who seemed poised to trigger a nuclear war between the superpowers. Where the Maser was an amplification of generated microwaves, the laser was an amplification of light, and theories about how this might be accomplished were circulating widely through the weapons development community even before Bell Labs produced the first Maser. I had seen the descriptions of the EBE laser in reports about the Roswell crash, a beam of light so thin that you couldn't see it until it landed on a target. What was the purpose of this light generator, the Alamogordo group had asked? It looked like a targeting or communications device, seemed to have an almost limitless range, and if the right power source could be found to amplify the light beam to where it could penetrate metal, the device could be used as a drill, a welder, or even a devastating weapon. Even while I was at the White House, all three branches of the military were working with researchers in university laboratories to develop a working laser. In theory, exciting the atoms of an element to produce light energy in the same way that atoms of gas were excited to produce microwaves lasers offered the tantalizing promise of a directed energy beam that had such a wide variety of applications, it could become an almost universal utility for all divisions of the military, even controlling warehouse inventory for the Quartermaster Corps. Finally, in 1958, the year after I left the White House, there was a surge in research activity, especially at Columbia University, where 2 years later, physicist Theodore Maiman constructed the first working laser. The first practical demonstration of the laser took place in 1960, and by the time I got to the Pentagon, General Trudeau had put it on our list of priorities to develop for military purposes. Also, because stimulated energy radiation devices were among the cache of technological debris we recovered from Roswell, the U.S. development of the laser encompassed the special urgent requirements of my Roswell mission. I had to write a report to General Trudeau suggesting ways the EBEs might have used laser technology in their missions on this planet and how we could develop similar uses for it under the guise of a conventional development program. In other words, once we guessed how the aliens were using it, it was to become our developmental model for similar applications. We believed that the EBEs used lasers for navigation by bouncing beams off distant objects in space and homing in on them to triangulate a course, for communications by using the laser beam as a carrier signal or as a signal in and of itself, for surveillance by painting potential targets with a beam, and for power transmission, illumination, and even data storage. The strength and integrity of the laser beam should have served as the EBE's primary method of communication over vast distances, or even as a way of storing communications in packages for later delivery. However, it was the EBE's use of directed energy as a medical tool and ultimately as a potential weapon that sent shivers up and down our spines, because to our minds it was evidence of the aliens' hostile intentions. Whether they saw us as true enemies to be destroyed or regarded all life on our planet as laboratory specimens to be experimented with, the results from the animal carcasses picked up in the field by our military, nuclear, biological, and chemical recovery teams and the civilian intelligence investigators could have been very much the same. In the Pentagon, from 1961 to 1963, I reviewed field reports from local and state police agencies about the discoveries of dead cattle whose carcasses looked as though they had been systematically mutilated, and reports from people who claimed to have been abducted by aliens and experimented on. One of the common threads in these stories were reports by the self-described abductees of being subjected to some sort of probing or even a form of surgery with controlled, intense, pencil-thin beams of light. Local police reported that when veterinarians were called to the scene to examine the dead cattle left in fields, they often found evidence not just that the animal's blood had been drained, but that entire organs were removed with such surgical skill that it couldn't have been the work of predators or vandals removing the organs for some depraved ritual. Where there was evidence of crime of someone staging a bizarre hoax, it was usually obvious from the clumsiness of the attempt and the deliberate staging of the carcass. And in the overwhelming majority of instances where the animal was killed by a predator who consumed its blood and carried away internal organs, the evidence of teeth marks or of a brief life and death struggle was also a clear indicator of what had happened. But in these cases, where investigators claimed to have been baffled by what they found, the removal of the organs and the draining of the animal's blood, where blood had been completely drained, were so sophisticated that there was almost no peripheral damage to the surrounding tissue. There was even some speculation in the early 1960s that whatever device the EBEs had deployed, it didn't even cut through the surrounding tissue. We had no medical instruments that even remotely approached what the aliens could do. It was as though some device had simply excised the organs with techniques that even went beyond our own surgical precision. While I was on the White House National Security Staff, and later when I was at the Pentagon, I was intrigued by these reports. I also remember that both civilian and military intelligence personnel attached to the staffs of individuals who worked for the Hill and Cotter and Twining Working Group on UFOs in the late 1950s were actively engaging in research into the kinds of surgical methods that would produce crime scene evidence like this. Could have been the Russians, they thought at first. Given the tense climate of the Cold War, a fear that the Soviets were experimenting with American livestock to develop some form of toxin or biological weapon that would devastate our cattle population was not unduly paranoid. It's sufficient to say, without going into any detail, that we were thinking about the same kinds of weapons. So it was not far-fetched to say that we were projecting our own doomsday strategies onto what the Russians might have done. But it wasn't the Soviets who were going after our cattle. In fact, the Soviet strategy for destabilizing the United States was so sophisticated that it was only a strategy of playing nuclear chicken with the Soviets that forced them to back down in the end. It was the EBEs who were experimenting with organ harvesting, possibly for transplant into other species or for processing into some sort of nutrient package or even to create some sort of hybrid biological entity. This is what people attached to the working group thought in the 1950s and 1960s, and even though we had no solid intelligence at the time that we were right, we operated on the assumption that no one takes an organ just for the sheer pleasure of removing it. Although the first public reports of cattle mutilation surfaced around 1967 in Colorado, at the White House we were reading about mutilation stories that had been kept out of the press as far back as the middle 1950s, especially in the area around Colorado. There was speculation also that maybe pharmaceutical companies were responsible because they could utilize the organs and soft tissues in biological experimentation, but we dismissed that because the companies had their own farms and could grow anything they wanted. Our intelligence organizations, and especially the working group, believed that the cattle mutilations that could not be obviously explained away as pranks, predators, or ritual slaughter were the results of interventions by extraterrestrials who were harvesting specific organs or for experimentation. So if our cattle were important enough to the EBEs to get them to expose what they were doing, it was an important thing for us to understand why. The EBEs were nothing if not coldly and clinically efficient. Their methodology reminded us of the Nazis, and they didn't waste time sitting around on the ground where they were most vulnerable to attack or capture unless they had a darn good reason for doing so. We didn't know their reasons back in the 1950s and 60s, and can only make educated guesses about them now. But back then, we were driven by a terror that unless we found ways to defend ourselves against the EBEs, we would be corralled by them and used for replacement tissue or as a source of nutrition. In 1997, this may sound like a nightmare out of a flying saucer horror movie, but in 1957, this was our thinking both in the White House and in the military. We didn't know, but we had irrefutable evidence that the EBEs were landing on farms, harvesting vital organs from livestock, and then just leaving the carcasses on the ground because they knew we couldn't do anything about it. The mutilations that interested the national security personnel seemed to have the same kind of modus operandi. Whoever went after the animals seemed most interested in the mammary, digestive, and reproductive organs, especially the uteruses from cows. In many cases, the eyes or throats were removed in a type of surgery in which the demarcation line was almost microscopically thin, and the surrounding tissue showed that the incision had superheated and then blackened as it cooled. But the crime scene and forensic specialists noted that in any type of cut by a predatory animal or a human, even a skilled surgeon, one would find evidence of some trauma in the surrounding tissue, such as swelling, contusions, or other forms of abrasion. In these reports of mutilations, forensic examination showed no evidence of collateral trauma or even inflammation. Therefore, they believed the cuts to extract the tissue were made so quickly and wounds were sealed so fast that the surrounding tissue never was destroyed. This meant that whoever was operating on these animals did so in a matter of minutes. It was rare, therefore, that police would ever catch them in the act. So if we couldn't protect our livestock or react intelligently to the stories of human abductions, except to debunk them and make the abductees think they were delusional, we had to find weapons that would put us on a more equal footing with the EBEs. One of these weapons, which had a wide application potential, was the laser, light amplification through stimulated energy radiation, the device the Army found in the Roswell spacecraft and would later develop as a weapon in cooperation with Hughes aircraft. Shortly after the first successful demonstration of a ruby-red laser at Columbia University, the three military branches realized they had a winner. The following year, the result of the tests at Columbia, the industry interest in developing laser-based products, and the Roswell report on stimulated energy all merged on my desk. Now it was my turn to get involved and assemble the information to support the laser product development with military funds before the whole operation was turned over to one of the R&D specialists who would take the product through his next stages. That was the way our backfield worked. I fed the play, made sure the snap got off, then faded in behind the blockers. By the time the ball carrier had made his way into the secondary, I was ready off the field. I never got the Heisman Trophy, but I sure as hell moved the ball. I began by listing the needs of the Army for what the laser might be able to accomplish, based on what the Army analysts reported they saw in the Roswell ship. It seemed to me obvious that if the Roswell laser was a cutting or surgical tool, the beam could also be utilized as an advanced rapid-fire weapon. With a beam so precise and directed, the laser would also make an excellent rangefinder and target manager for artillery. If the beam was capable of instantaneous readjustment and fed into a computer, it would also be the perfect targeting system for a tank, especially a tank on the move. Typically, a tank must stop before it can fire because the gunner needs to have a fixed firing platform from which he can calculate range, direction, and other compensating factors. The laser can do all that while the vehicle is moving and should therefore enable a tank to stay on the move while firing. And if a laser can paint a target from a tank and find the range, I speculated, it can do the same for a helicopter from air to air and air to ground. I suggested to General Trudeau that all the research we were conducting into helicopter tactics, especially the role of helicopters as infantry support gun and rocket platforms, dovetailed perfectly with the possibilities of the laser as a range-finding mechanism. We could paint friendly troops to locate them, identify our foes, and illuminate potential targets with light invisible to all but our own gunners. At the same time, our own bombs or missiles can home in on the laser image we project onto a target, like a heat-seeking missile. Once painted, the target could evade the laser-guided rocket or shell only with great difficulty. For a stationary target such as a fortification or artillery redoubt, a laser-guided shell would be particularly devastating because we could take it out with one or two rounds instead of having to go back again and again to make sure we'd found the target. As a signal, A laser is so intense, refined, and perfectly stable that it is almost impervious to any kind of disturbance. For this reason, I wrote General Trudeau, the EBEs must have used an advanced form of a laser for their communication. And we can too. The intensity of the beam and its highly refined focus mean that it can be aimed with minute precision. Amplifying the power to boost the signal should not distort the beam's aim, which makes it perfect for straight-line, long-distance communication. Lasers also have high capacities for carrying multiple signals. Therefore, I wrote the general, we can pack a greater number of transmission bands into a laser signal than we can with our conventional signal carriers. This meant that we could literally flood a battlefield with different kinds of communication channels, each carrying different kinds of communication, some not even invented yet, and have them securely carried by laser signals. For command and control on the increasingly sophisticated electronic battlefield the Army was predicting for the 1970s, lasers would become the Signal Corps workhorses. General Trudeau said that he was also interested in an item from one of the specification reports that other military observers wrote that said lasers could also serve as projection devices for large screen displays. Lasers were so bright that displays could be shown in rooms that didn't have to be darkened. The general saw the possibility of fully lit situation rooms with large screen displays from satellite radar transmissions. The room would allow computer operators to see what they were doing at their keyboards while seeing the display and listening to the briefing. I suggested that the Army Cartography Division would be particularly interested in the accuracy of the laser-derived measurements for maps. That same measurement ability would also be able to generate digital data for ground-hugging infantry support helicopters or low-flying planes. Aircraft that could stay close to the ground could avoid enemy radar and stay concealed until the last minute. But unless there was a method for accurately charting the topography, aircraft could find themselves scraping treetops or crashing into the side of a hill. If a laser could accurately transmit topographic features to altitude control and navigational computers on board attack aircraft, it would keep the aircraft safely above any ground obstacles, but close enough to the ground to remain concealed. This ground-hugging capability that I suggested to General Trudeau had been suggested to me from the analysis reports of UFOs that also had this capability. It was what enabled them to hover close to the ground and to move rapidly at speeds over 1,000 miles an hour at treetop levels without hitting anything. The laser-type devices aboard the UFO instantly fed the craft with topographic features of the landscape, and the craft automatically adjusted to the terrain. In late 1961, General Trudeau asked me to visit Fort Belvoir again, this time to meet a Dr. Mark Johnston, one of the aeronautical research scientists from Hughes Aircraft. Fort Belvoir was one of the safe houses for the Office of R&D to conduct meetings in because it was a secure facility. My comings and goings there on Army R&D business were completely routine, even to the CIA surveillance teams that would occasionally pick up my car coming out of the Pentagon, and could be covered in our daily logs with references to the ongoing projects that served as covers. My meeting with Johnston, for example, was to talk about the Hughes helicopter development program, not to give him any reports on laser measuring devices we believe were in the Roswell spacecraft. I briefed Johnston on what the scientific team from Alamogordo believed was on the spacecraft, asked him not to talk about it, and suggested that the Hughes team developing the navigational radars for the helicopter project consider using the newly developed lasers as terrain measuring apparatus and for target acquisition. Yes, of course, I assured him. The Office of R&D would have a development budget for the laser project if the R&D team at Hughes thought our idea was feasible and they could develop it. And that's exactly what happened. using the positive results from the Columbia University test and the Army weapons specifications, we drew up an R&D for the requirements of a rangefinder, targeting, and tracking weapon, and with research grants from the Pentagon, Hughes signed on as one of the contractors for the military laser. Today, the laser has become the HEL, or High Energy Laser, deployed by the Army Space Defense Command as, among other things, an anti-satellite, anti-warhead weapon. My meeting at Hughes was quick and direct. Like so many of the research scientists I met with from Hughes, Dow, IBM, and Bell, Johnston disappeared behind the workbenches, computer screens, or test tubes of the company's back room and out of my sight forever. When General Trudeau would ask me to follow up on the project months later, a different company representative would meet with me, and the project would look just like any other Army R&D-initiated research contract. Any traces of Roswell or the nut file would be gone, and the project would have slipped into the normal R&D functioning. Of course this device didn't come out of the Roswell incident. The incident was only a myth. It never took place. This came out of the Foreign Technology Desk, something the Italians or French were working on, and we picked up through intelligence sources. Our work with laser products was becoming so successful by the end of 1961 that General Trudeau was urging me to spread the wealth around to as many Army bases as I could. I spoke to weapons experts at Fort Riley, Kansas, for example, about the use of lasers by troops in the field, maybe as range finders, we suggested, or even as ways to lock on a target the way the Air Force was experimenting with something they were calling smart bombs. By 1964, after seeing the research into the feasibility of lasers that we had commissioned, handheld range finders were being tested at Army bases around the country, and today, police forces use laser sights on their weapons. Lasers became one of the Army's great successes. In one of our final pushes for the development of laser-based weapon systems, we argued successfully for a budget to develop laser tracking systems for incoming missiles. This was a project we fought hard for over political opposition as well as opposition from the other military branches, which were looking at our proposal as a conventional method of tracking missiles. The laser was too new, they argued. Atmospheric interference or heavy clouds would distort the lasers over long distances, they said. Or, they said, it would simply take too much power and would have no portability. General Trudeau and I had another agenda for this project that we couldn't really share with anybody. We believed that lasers could be used not just to track incoming missiles. That was obvious. We saw the lasers, too, as our best weapon for not only tracking UFOs from the ground, from aircraft, or from satellites, but if we could boost the power to the necessary levels for shooting them down. Shoot down a few of them, we speculated, and they wouldn't violate our airspaces with such impunity. Equip our fighter planes or interceptors with laser firing mechanisms, and we could pose a credible threat to them. Equip our satellites with laser firing mechanisms, and we could triangulate a firing pattern on the UFOs that might even keep them away from our orbiting spacecraft. But all of this was speculation in late 1961. Only a very few people in the other branches of R&D even had a hint about what we were proposing. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration had its own plans for developing laser tracking systems and didn't want to share any development budget with the military, so there was very little help forthcoming from NASA. The Air Force and Navy were guarding their own development budgets for laser weapons, and we couldn't trust the civilian intelligence agencies at all. So General Trudeau and I began advocating a plan as a cover to develop laser tracking and other sophisticated types of surveillance projects. It was outrageous on the surface, but it quickly found its adherents, and its real agenda could be completely masked. We could never call it an anti-UFO device, so we named it an anti-missile missile. It was one of the most successful projects ever to come out of Army R&D. It owed most of its theory to our discovery of the laser in the Roswell wreckage. Chapter 14. The Anti-Missile-Missile Project. There were times during my tenure at the Pentagon when something in the Roswell file had such resonance in my life that it made me question whether there was some larger plan for my work. I've read about the concept of synchronicity or confluence in the years since I retired from the military, and how things or events tend to cluster around a common thread. Such a common thread was the development of the anti-missile missile that encompassed my work in R&D at the Pentagon, my brief stint as a staff advisor to Senator Strom Thurmond, and my years in Rome during the war and occupation as the Assistant Chief of Staff Intelligence G2, Rome Area Allied Command. In early 1963, just after I left the Pentagon, Senator Strom Thurmond asked me to join his staff as a consultant and an advisor on military and national security issues. Congress had just appropriated $300 million to turn a fledgling plan to investigate the feasibility of an anti-missile-missile program into a full development project. But it ran right into a concrete barrier just as soon as it left the Senate. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara flatly refused to spend the money because he said not only would it intensify the U.S.-Soviet arms race, it would actually offend the Kremlin because it would put them on notice that we were trying to deploy a first-strike capability while neutralizing their ICBMs. Worse, he said to the Congress, the United States military simply didn't need the weapon in the first place. Senator Thurmond was incensed, and I was deeply worried McNamara just didn't get it. He was completely misinformed about how the Soviets reacted to any weapons deployment on our part. They didn't negotiate with us out of a sense of cooperation, only a sense of necessity that it was in their best interest to do so. If they thought we could knock out their ICBMs, that more than anything would keep them honest. Hadn't they backed down over Cuba because they saw that Kennedy actually meant business when he screwed up his resolve to order the Navy to enforce the blockade? But the CIA had McNamara's ear and was giving him exactly the information the disinformation specialists in the Kremlin wanted him to have. Don't develop the anti-missile missile. General Trudeau and I had a secret agenda we had worked up the previous year at the Pentagon. The anti-missile missile utilizing laser targeting and tracking was supposed to be the perfect mechanism for getting the funds to develop a laser beam weapon we could ultimately use to fire on UFOs. At least, that was the way we'd planned it. The general had gotten it through the Pentagon bureaucracy while I covered his flank on the legislative side testifying before the Armed Services Committee on the efficacy of a weapon that was capable of protecting American strategic forces with an umbrella. If any country were foolish enough to attack the United States, the anti-missile missile would blunt their offensive and enable us not only to devastate their military forces, but hold their population centers hostage as well. Not so, said the Defense Department. The deployment of an anti-missile missile would encourage our enemies to attack our cities first and devastate our civilian population. What did it matter if we had the ability to strike back when the damage to us had already been done? The only thing that was keeping our civilian population centers safe was each side's ability to hold the other's nuclear forces hostage. If both sides devastated one another's nuclear forces, it would give each side time to stop before a mutual destruction of the civilian populations. But the Secretary of Defense didn't understand war. He especially hadn't seen what lessons the Soviets learned during World War II when their population centers had been devastated and people were reduced to the point of starvation and cannibalized one another for food. That kind of experience doesn't toughen you against the ravages of war, it educates you. The Soviets' only hope for victory in the Cold War was an hour putting down our guard and capitulating to them. By refusing to go forward with the anti-missile missile, the Secretary of Defense was listening to arguments that were spoon-fed to him, certainly without his knowledge, by people in the civilian intelligence community who were being manipulated by the KGB. Senator Thurmond's reaction to Bob McNamara's refusal to spend the anti-missile missile appropriation was to hold subcommittee hearings on this issue to find out why. The Defense Department didn't want to disclose classified information about the capabilities of a proposed weapon and our defense policy before a public session of Congress. So Fred Buzhardt, who years later became President Nixon's counsel, suggested that Senator Thurmond invoke a senatorial privilege to close a session of the Senate so that the issue of the anti-missile missile could be discussed in private before the full Senate. But first, we had to request specific information from the Department of Defense, and that task, because I was the senator's advisor for military affairs, fell to me. No one knew that I was actually the officer who had initially prepared the information for the anti-missile missile program to begin with, and probably knew more about the documents than anyone, because less than a year earlier, I prepared them myself. The first meeting with the Defense Department was held in my new office in the basement of the Capitol building. Secretary McNamara sent his own scientific advisor, Harold Brown, who would later become the Secretary of Defense himself, along with an Army colonel who would become the project officer for the anti-missile missile development program. Brown didn't know who I was, but his assistant from the Army certainly did. "Colonel," the Army project officer began as soon as I asked him a question about the request we'd sent for information, and Harold Brown sat straight up in his chair. Gradually, like chipping away parts of a granite block, I asked the project officer about the specific details of the anti-missile missile program. How much of the budget allocation from previous Pentagon funding they'd already spent, and what their development timetable would be if the current appropriation were spent for the current phase of the project. Then I asked more technical questions about the research into the ground-based radars, satellite-based radars, speculation into Soviet counter-anti-missile missile strategies, and Soviet development of even bigger and more mobile ICBMs that would present more imperative targets for any anti-missile missile system because we couldn't take them out in the first strike. Mounted on railway cars or trucks, mobile Soviet missiles would be almost impossible to track, even though they would have to remain stationary for the liquid fueling process to be completed. "I see that my assistant keeps on calling you Colonel, Mr. Corso," Harold Brown said, "and you certainly seem to know a lot of details on this subject." "Yes, sir," I said. "I only retired from the Army a couple of months ago, but while I was at the Pentagon, I was the acting projects officer for the anti-missile missile program." "Then there's no use in holding back," Harold Brown said, and finally smiled for the first time in our meeting. He reached into his pocket and pulled out a folded envelope. "Here are your copies of the complete details of the project about which we briefed President Kennedy. It's all here, and I presume this is what you're looking for officially," he said with a special emphasis on officially. He knew that I knew what was in that envelope but couldn't disclose it before the Senate because it contained classified information and I would be breaching the National Security Act. However, by giving me the material, much of it based on information that I had already developed myself and had privately briefed Attorney General Robert Kennedy on in 1962, Brown was giving me the full authorization to disclose. He probably realized that in private meetings, I had talked generally about what was in the Army file on the anti-missile missile. That was a form of senatorial privilege as long as it wasn't abused. But that I couldn't go formal with it. Now I could, and I appreciated Harold Brown's candor. The battle over the appropriation was about to be joined, but I couldn't look over the contents of the envelope, some of which were my own notes, without thinking back to the sequence of events that led to this meeting and to the project that ultimately was developed as a result of it. It began earlier in 1962, as I was working down the list of priorities I had set for myself in the Nutt file. It was a medical report about the creatures that I was trying to save until I had gotten all the tangible items from Roswell into the development process. It was a report on the possible function and apparent structure of the alien brain, a report that marveled at the similarities between the EBE brain and the human brain. However, one item in the report threw me for a complete loop. The medical examiner wrote that measurements of the brain activity taken from the EBE who was still barely alive at Roswell showed that its electronic signature, at least what they were able to measure with equipment in 1947, displayed a signal similar to what we would call long, low-frequency waves. And the examiner referred to a description by one of the Roswell Army airfield doctors that the creature's brain lobes seemed to have been not just physiologically and neurologically integrated, but integrated by an electromagnetic current as well. I would have loved to dismiss this as the speculation of a doctor who had no experience with this type of analysis and certainly no experience with alien beings. Therefore, whatever he wrote was nonsense and not worth the time it took to respond to it. File it back in the cabinet and get on to other issues that could be turned into viable projects. But the medical examiner's report was more disturbing than I was ready to admit, because it took me back to a time when I was the assistant chief of staff in Rome and made friends with some of the members of the graduate faculty at the University of Rome. I was a 25-year-old captain at the time, a former engineering undergraduate, way in over my head and learning my job responsibilities each day, keeping one step ahead of my boss so he wouldn't find out that I didn't really know anything. In one of my visits to the university, I met Dr. Gislero Flesch, a professor of criminology and anthropology who had lectured me on what he called his theory and experiments on the basis of life. It was wild, and I thought, supernatural theory on what he called the filament within each cell. The filament was activated by some cosmic action or form of electromagnetic radiation that bombarded the Earth continuously from outer space and resonated against the constant refresh of electrical activity from the brain. Capitan, he would say whenever he began some formal explanation. I also thought he was always surprised that someone so young could actually be dispatched from the New World to administer law and justice in Rome, the capital of the ancient world. The old professor also was scrupulous about showing everyone, including his dimmest of students, extraordinary respect. "The electromagnetic forces in the body are the least understood," he continued, "yet they account for more activity than anyone realizes." As an engineering student whose whole experience with energy had to do with verifiable experiments, I was more than skeptical at first. How can you measure an electrical activity in the brain that you cannot see? How could invisible waves of energy that you can't feel or see excite certain areas of the human cell? And what was their purpose? Professor Flesch introduced me to Professor Casimiro Frank, one of the first scientists to ever photograph brainwaves. Professor Frank became a friend because during my days in Rome, fighting off Gestapo agents, communist partisans, and the local crime families and crime chieftains, I was always engaged in some type of warfare. But when I had time off, I wanted to meet people, to stretch my experience, to fall in love with the city of my own ancestors I had been assigned to protect. So I sought out a network of friends to whom I could relate and from whom I could learn. Professor Frank was just such a man. In Frank's first experiments, he had used a rabbit brain as a test subject. He measured what he said were the long, low-frequency waves animal brains generate, and described how he was able to trace the paths these waves took when they were transmitted from the brain to the animal's voluntary muscles. Certain muscles, Professor Frank said, were attuned to respond to certain brain wavelengths, waves of a specific frequency. In case of muscle paralysis, it's not the muscle that's necessarily damaged, it's the muscle's tuning mechanism that becomes disabled, so that it no longer picks up the right frequency. It's like a radio, he said. If the radio can't pick up a signal, the radio isn't necessarily broken. Its antenna, or the crystal, may need to be adjusted to the correct frequency. I was a guest in his laboratory more than a few times and watched him carry out his experiments with live rabbits, interfering with their brain's electromagnetic wave propagation by implanting electrodes and seeing which muscles became cataleptic and which responded. He said it was the frequency that was being altered because once the animal was removed from the experimental table, it could walk and hop as if nothing had ever happened. Then Professor Frank introduced me to another one of his colleagues, the celebrated research biologist and physician Dr. Castellani, who had many years earlier isolated and identified the disease called sleeping sickness, and perfected what during the 1930s and 1940s became known as Castellani ointments, as treatments for a variety of skin diseases. Where other doctors, he said, had focused on treating only the symptoms they could see on the skin, Dr. Castellani said that the problems of many skin rashes, psoriasis, or inflammations that looked like bacterial infections were in fact correctable by changing the skin's electromagnetic resonance. The ointments, he said, didn't attack the infection with drugs. They were chemical reactants that changed the electrostatic condition of the skin, allowing the long, low-frequency waves from the brain to do the healing. All three men were using these electromagnetic waves to promote healing in ways I considered astounding. They made claims about the ability of electromagnetic treatments to affect the speed at which cells divide and tumors grow. They claimed that through directed electromagnetic wave propagation, they could cure heart disease, arthritis, all types of bacteriological infections that interfered with cell function, and even certain forms of cancer. If this sounds like something supernatural in 1997, imagine how it must have sounded to the ears of a young and inexperienced intelligence officer in 1944 who was so far out of his element that the older, seasoned British intelligence laughed at his age. They laughed until they saw what happened to the Gestapo agents who were trying to infiltrate Rome behind the Allied front lines and met up with my men on the back streets and alleys. That's when the laughing stopped. I spent many hours with Professors Flesch, Frank, and Castellani in Rome and watched them experiment with all kinds of small animals. They didn't have the research funds nor the endorsements of the medical societies to allow them to expand their work or to treat patients with their unconventional methods. Thus, much of their work found its way into research monographs, articles in academic journals, or university lectures at symposiums. And I left Rome in the spring of 1947, said my goodbyes to the friends I had made at the University of Rome, and put their work, relegated once again to the supernatural, out of my mind as I concentrated on my new jobs at Fort Riley, the White House, Red Canyon, Germany, and the Pentagon. Then, on the day that I came across the speculative report on the structure of the alien brain from Roswell, everything Professors Flesch, Frank, and Castellani said came back to me like a clap of thunder. Here I was again, staring at a piece of loose-leaf paper that was staring right back at me and forcing me to consider ideas and notions from over 10 years ago that challenged everything science back then was telling us about the way the brain worked. While I reviewed the reports about the autopsied alien brain and what the medical examiner thought the low-frequency waves meant when he applied current to the tissue, I also saw reports from an Army military liaison attached to the Stalingrad consulate office that described Soviet experiments with psychics who were attempting to exercise some form of kinetic mind control over objects traveling through the air, directing them from one spot to the other. These reports, written in the late 1950s, gave General Trudeau a lot of concern because they showed the Soviets were onto something. "These fellas don't waste their time, Phil," the general told me at one of our morning briefings after I had dropped off the reports the day before so he could look them over. "If they're looking into this stuff, then they know there's something there." "You don't think this report is a lot of speculation?" I asked. I knew from the expression on his face that it was a question I shouldn't have asked. "If you thought this was just speculation, Colonel," he said very abruptly, "then you wouldn't be passing the buck up to me to tell you that." General Trudeau had a way of bringing you up short when he thought you said something stupid. And what I had said was very stupid for an officer with my training and experience. He also knew I was worried, or else I wouldn't have tried to back off so quickly. "You're right to be worried about this," he said, his tone softening when he saw how I was looking at him. "You'd be right if you sat in your office and sweated bullets over what this means. And you know exactly what worries the both of us. Do I have to say it?" No, he didn't. It was obvious. If the Soviets had gotten their hands on some of the apparatus from any one of the alien spacecraft that had gone down since 1947, and I didn't know how many of them there were, they'd have figured out by now that the aliens had used some form of brainwave control for navigation. How they directed their thoughts or translated them into an electronic circuit, we didn't know. But we knew that there were no steering wheels or conventional methods of control on the spacecraft, and the headbands we found with the electronic sensors on them were designed to pick up some form of signal from the brain. The analysts at Wright Field believed that the sensors on the headbands corresponded with points on the multi-lobed alien brain that generated low-frequency waves, so the headbands formed an integral part of the circuit. If we were able to figure this out, the Soviets were certainly capable of figuring that out as well. Besides, the general didn't have to say it, because I thought it. What if the Soviets, all alone in space the way they were in the early 1960s, had some communication with the aliens that we didn't have? Who said the EBEs had to be anti-communist anyway? General Trudeau also shared with me some intelligence reports that described anti-missile tests the Soviet Union had conducted with very powerful tracking radar. We'd known about their radars because I'd seen them work during exercises in Germany when one side would test the other's responses over the East German border. Their radars and their ability to lock onto aircraft was just as good as ours. But what the general showed me were reports that described the Soviets firing intercept missiles at incoming ICBM vehicles and exploding the intercept warhead so as to knock out the navigational systems on the aggressor missiles. One of these test intercepts had been conducted successfully right through an atomic cloud on one of the Soviet missile test ranges in Asia. This was especially disturbing because anyone who knows anything about the nature of an atomic cloud knows that the electromagnetic pulse immediately knocks out any form of electronics. That's also how we knew what the signatures were of the alien UFOs that buzzed our ships and bases. So much of our non-hardened power was knocked out by the pulse that we knew an electromagnetic wave had hit us. So if the Soviets could harden their anti-missile guidance system to home in on a target through an electromagnetically charged atomic cloud, they were using a technology significantly more advanced than ours, and it spelled trouble. "When you were in Germany commanding the Nike battalion," the general asked me, still holding the reports in his hand, "you experimented with tight, evasive maneuvers in drone target practice, didn't you?" The general's memory served him